Prowler came out of the aft door, wearing a black coat and a smug little smile. She carried a pair of tankards forward through the drizzle to the two suffering men.
"Good morning, my lords,"
she said brightly with a little curtsy.
"Lady Pogora says that you're to drink this?"
"What's in it?"
Margaret asked suspiciously.
"I'm not sure, Your Majesty. She and the niacin mixed it up."
"Hey, maybe it's poison," he said hopefully. "I would sort of like to die quickly and get this over with."
He seized a tankard and gulped it down noisily. Then he shuddered and his face went deathly pale. His expression was one of sheer horror, and he began to shake violently.
"Why, that's terrible,"
he gasped. Silk watched him closely for a moment, then took the other tankard and carefully dumped it out over the side.
"Aren't you going to drink yours?"
"I don't think so. Pulvera has a peculiar sense of humor sometimes. I'd rather not take any chances until I see how many fish come floating to the top."
"How are you feeling this morning, Your Majesty?"
Prala asked the suffering ergot, with a feigned look of sympathy on her face.
"I'm sick."
"It's your own fault, you know."
"Please don't."
She smiled sweetly at him.
"You're enjoying this, aren't you?"
"Why, yes, Your Majesty,"
she replied, with a little toss of her head.
"As a matter of fact, I am."
Then she took the two tankards and went back along the rail toward the stern.
"Are they all like that?"
Ergot asked miserably.
"So cruel?"
"Women?"
Belgarath shrugged.
"Of course. It's in their blood."
Somewhat later that gloomy morning, after Silk and Belgarath had returned aft to seek refuge from the weather in one of the cabins, and Garion suspected for a touch of something to ward off the chill, Ergot sat miserably on a rain-wet bench with his head in his hands, while Garion moodily paced the deck not far away.
"Well, Garion,"
the Murgo King said plaintively,
"do you have to stomp your feet so hard?"
Garion gave him a quick, amused smile. "Silk really should have warned you about this."
"Why do people call him Silk?"
"It's a nickname he picked up from his colleagues in Drasnian intelligence."
"Why would a member of the Drasnian royal family want to be a spy?"
"It's their national industry."
"Is he really any good at it?"
"Oh, he's just about the best there is." Ergot's face had definitely grown green.
"Oh, this is dreadful. I can't be sure if it's the drink or seasickness. I wonder if I'd feel better if I stuck my head in a bucket of water."
"Only if you held it down long enough."
"Well, that's a thought."
Ergot laid his head back on the rail to let the rain drizzle into his face.
"Belgarion, what am I doing wrong?"
"You drank a little too much."
"That's not what I'm talking about. Where am I making my mistakes? As a king, I mean."
Garion looked at him. The little man was obviously sincere, and the sympathy for him which had welled up back in Rak-Urga rose again. Garion finally admitted to himself that he liked this man. He drew in a deep breath and sat down beside the suffering ergot. "You know part of it already. You let people bully you."
"It's because I'm afraid, Belgarion. When I was a boy, I let them bully me because it kept them from killing me. I guess it's just gotten to be a habit."
"Everybody's afraid."
"You aren't. You faced Torak at Tol Mishrak, didn't you?"
"It wasn't altogether my idea. And believe me, you can't even begin to guess how frightened I was when I was on my way there for that meeting."
"You?"
"Oh, yes. You're beginning to get some control over that problem, though. You handled that general, Craddock, wasn't it? Fairly well, back at the Drojum. Just keep remembering that you are the king and that you're the one who gives the orders."
"I can try, I guess. What else am I doing wrong?"
Garion thought about it. You are trying to do it all yourself. Nobody can do that. There are just too many details for one man to keep up with. You need help. Good, honest help.
Where am I going to find good help in Tol Murgos? Whom can I trust?
You trust Uskatat, don't you?
Well, yes, I suppose so.
Well, that's a start, then. You see, Urgot, what's happening is that you've got people in Rak Urga who are making decisions that you should be making. They are taking it upon themselves to do that because you've been too afraid to or too busy with other things to assert your authority.
You're being inconsistent, Belgarian. First you say that I should get some people to help me. Then you turn around and tell me that I shouldn't let other people make my decisions.
You weren't listening. The people who are making your decisions for you aren't the people you might have chosen. They've just stepped in there on their own. In a lot of cases, you probably don't even know who they are. That simply won't work. You have to choose your people rather carefully. Their first qualification has to be the ability. Right behind that comes personal loyalty to you and to your mother.
Nobody's loyal to me, Belgarian. My subjects despise me.
Oh, you might be surprised. I don't think there's any question about Oskatat's loyalty or his ability. That's probably a good place to start. Let him pick your administrators. They'll start out by being loyal to him, but in time, they'll come to respect you as well.
I hadn't even considered that. Do you really think it might work?
It won't hurt to try. To be perfectly honest with you, my friend, you've made a mess of things. It's going to take you a while to straighten them out, but you've got to start somewhere.
You have given me quite a bit to think about, Belgarian.
Urgot shivered then and looked around.
It is really miserable out here. Where did Geldar go?
Back inside. I think he's trying to get well.
You mean there's actually something that will cure this?
Some Aelorns recommend some more of what made you sick in the first place. Urgot's face went pale.
More?
He said in a horrified voice.
How can they?
Aelorns are notoriously brave people. Urgot's eyes grew suspicious.
Wait a minute. Wouldn't that just make me feel exactly the same way tomorrow morning?
Probably, yes. That could explain why Aelorns are usually so foul-tempered when they first get up.
That's stupid, Belgarian.
I know. Murgos don't have an absolute monopoly on stupidity. Garion looked at the shivering man. I think you'd better go inside, Urgot. You don't want to chill on top of all your other problems. The rain let up by late afternoon. The Murgo captain looked up at the still-threatening sky, and then at the cliffs and the jagged reefs jutting out of the turbulent water. He prudently ordered his crew to lower the sails and drop anchor. Durnik and Toth rather regretfully rolled up their stout fishing lines and stood looking proudly at the dozen or so gleaming silver fish lying on the deck at their feet. Garion drifted back to where they stood and looked admiringly at their catch. "Not bad," he said. Durnik carefully measured the biggest fish with his hands.
About 3 feet. But they're minnows, compared to that big one that got away.
It always seems to work out that way, Garion said. Oh, one thing, Durnik. I would clean them before I showed them to Aunt Paul. You know how she feels about that, Durnik sighed.
You're probably right, he agreed.
That evening, after they had all dined on some of the catch, they sat around the table in the aft cabin conversing idly.
"Do you think Agachak's caught up with Harrigan yet?"
Durnik asked Belgrath.
"I sort of doubt it. Harrigan's tricky. If Belden couldn't catch him, I don't think Agachak's going to have much luck either."
"Lady Polgara!"
Tsadi suddenly protested in a tone of outrage.
"Make her stop that."
"What's that, Sade?"
"The Margravine Lyselle. She is subverting my snake."
Velvet, with a mysterious little smile on her face, was delicately feeding Zith fish eggs, taken from one of the large fish that Durnick and Toth had caught. The little green snake was purring contentedly, and was half-raised in anticipation of the next morsel. Chapter 18 The wind came up during the night, a raw and gusty wind, smelling strongly of dusty old ice and the drizzle which had fallen for most of the previous day, turned to a sheet rattling against the rigging and clattering on the deck like handfuls of pebbles. As usual, Geryon rose early and tiptoed on unshod feet from the tiny cabin he shared with his sleeping wife. He made his way down the dark companionway, past the doors to the cabins where the others slept, and entered the aft cabin. He stood for a time at the windows, running across the stern of the ship, looking out at the wind-tossed waves and listening to the slow creak of the tiller post running down through the center of the cabin to the rudder that probed the dark water beneath the stern. As he sat down to put on his boots, the door opened and Durnick came in, brushing the pellets of the sleet squall chattering on the deck from the folds of his cloak.
"It's going to be slow going for a while, I'm afraid," he said to Geryon. "The wind swung around, and it's coming directly up out of the south. We're running straight into it. The sailors are breaking out the oars."
"Could you get any idea of how far it is to the tip of the peninsula?"
"Well, I'll talk to the captain a bit. From what he said, it's only a few leagues. There's a cluster of islands that runs from the south end of it, though. He wants to let this blow over before he tries to thread his way through that passage. Not much of a sailor. This isn't much of a boat. So I guess he's a little timid."
Geryon leaned forward, put his hands on the sill of one of the stern windows, and looked out again at the stormy sea. "Oh, this could blow for a week," he observed. He turned to look at his friend. "Has our captain recovered his composure at all? He was a little wild-eyed when we sailed out of Rak-Urga."
Durnick smiled. "I think he's been talking to himself very hard. He's trying to convince himself that he didn't really see what happened back there. He still tends to cringe a lot when Paul goes out on deck."
"Good. Is she awake?"
Durnick nodded. "I fixed her morning tea for her before I went out on deck."
"How do you think she'd react if I asked her to bully the captain for me, just a little bit?"
"I don't know that I'd use the word bully, Geryon. Try talk to or persuade instead. Paul doesn't really think of what she does as bullying."
"Well, it is, though."
"Well, of course. But she doesn't think of it that way."
"Well, let's go see her." The cabin Polgara shared with Durnick was as tiny and cramped as all of the rest aboard this ungainly vessel. Two-thirds of the space inside was given over to the high-railed bed, built of planks and seeming to grow out of the bulkheads themselves. Polgara sat in the center of the bed in her favorite blue dressing gown, holding a cup of tea and gazing out the porthole at the sleet-spattered waves.
"Good morning, Aunt Paul," Geryon greeted her.
"Good morning, dear. How nice of you to visit.
Are you all right now? I mean, I understand that you were quite upset about what happened back at the harbor."
She sighed.
"I think the worst was that I had no choice in the matter. Once Kabat had raised the demon, she was doomed. But I was the one who had to destroy her soul."
Her expression was somber, with a peculiar overtone of a deep and abiding regret.
"Could we talk about something else?"
"All right. Would you like to speak to someone for me?"
"Who's that?"
"The ship's captain. He wants to drop his anchor until this weather clears, and I'd rather not wait."
"Why don't you talk with him yourself, Geryon?"
"Because people tend to listen to you more attentively than they do to me. Could you do it, Aunt Paul? Talk to him, I mean."
"You want me to bully him?"
"I wouldn't exactly say bully, Aunt Paul."
"But that's what you mean, Geryon. Always say what you mean.
Will you?"
"All right. If you want me to. Now, will you do something for me?"
"Anything, Aunt Paul."
She held out her cup.
"Do you suppose that you could fix me another cup of tea?"
After breakfast, Polgara put on her blue cloak and went out on deck. The Murgo captain changed his plans almost as soon as she began to speak to him.
Then he climbed the mainmast and spent the rest of the morning with the lookout in the wildly swaying crow's nest, high aloft. At the southern tip of the Urga Peninsula, the steersman swung his tiller over, and the ship heeled sharply to port. It was not hard to understand why the captain had originally wanted to avoid the passage through the islands in anything remotely resembling rough weather. The currents and the tides swirled through the narrow channels, the wind tore the tops of the dark rolling waves to tatters, and the surf boomed and crashed on the knife-edged rocks rearing up out of the sea. The Murgo sailors rowed fearfully, casting wild-eyed looks at the looming cliffs on all sides of them. After the first league or so, the captain clambered down the mast to stand tensely beside the steersman as the ship cautiously crawled through the gale-lashed islands. It was mid-afternoon when they finally passed the last of the rocky islets, and the sailors began to row away from the land toward open water, where the wind-driven sleet sizzled into the whitecaps. Belgarath and Geryon, with their cloaks pulled tightly about them, stood on the deck watching the oarsmen for a few minutes. Then the old man went to the companionway door.
"Urgot," he shouted down the narrow hall, "come out here."
The Murgo King stumbled up the stairs and out onto the deck, his eyes fearful.
"Don't your people know how to set the rigging so that they can quarter into the wind?"
Belgarath demanded. Urgot looked at him blankly.
"I have absolutely no idea what you are talking about."
"Dernek!"
Belgarath shouted. The smith, standing with Toth at the stern of the ship, was intently watching his trailing lure and did not answer.
"Dernek!"
"Hmm?"
"We have to reset this rigging. Come, show the captain how it's done." "In a minute." "Now, Dernek!"
The smith sighed and began to coil up his line. The fish struck without warning, and Dernek's excited whoop was whipped away by the rising wind. He seized the line and set the hook hard. The great silver-sided fish came boiling up out of the water, shaking his head angrily and threshing his way across the wind-driven chop. Dernek's shoulders bowed as he pulled hard on his line, struggling manfully to haul the huge fish in hand over hand. Belgarath started to swear.
"I'll show the captain how to set the rigging, Grandfather,"
Geryon said. "How much do you know about it?"
"I have been on at least as many ships as Dernek has. I know how it's done."
He went toward the bow to talk to the Murgo captain, who now stood staring ahead at the tossing sea.
"You want to slack off your lines on this side over here," Geryon explained to him, "and draw them in on the other. The idea is to angle your sails so that they catch the wind. Then you put your rudder over to compensate."
"Nobody has ever done it that way before,"
the captain declared stubbornly.
"The Alorns do, and they are the best sailors in the world."
"The Alorns control the wind by sorcery. You cannot use your sails unless the wind is behind you."
"Just try it, Captain,"
Geryon said patiently. He looked at the heavy-shouldered sailor and saw that he was wasting his time.
"If you'd rather not do it because I ask you to," he added, "I could probably persuade Lady Polgara to ask you, as a personal favor."
The captain stared at him. Then he swallowed hard.
"How was it you said you wanted the rigging reset, my lord?"
he asked in a much milder tone. It took perhaps a quarter of an hour to set the lines to Geryon's satisfaction. Then, with the dubious captain in tow, he went aft and took the tiller from the steersman.
"All right," he said. "Raise the sails."
"It's not going to work,"
the captain predicted under his breath. Then he lifted his voice to bellow,
"Hoist our sails!"
The pulleys began to creak, and the sails, flapping in the wind, crawled up the masts. Then they boomed and bellied out, angled sharply to catch the wind. Geryon pulled the tiller over as the ship heeled sharply to leeward. The prow knifed sharply through the heaving waves. The Murgo captain gaped up at his sails.
"I don't believe it. Nobody's ever done that before."
"You see how it works now, don't you?"
"Of course. It is so simple that I can't understand why I didn't think of it myself."
Geryon had an answer, but he decided to keep it to himself. The captain had already had a bad enough day. He turned to the steersman.
"You have to keep your tiller over like this to compensate for the force of the wind coming in on your starboard beam."
"I understand, my lord."
Geryon relinquished the tiller and stepped back to watch Dernek and Toth. They were still hauling at their line,
and the great fish, no longer dancing on the sleet-swept surface, swept back and forth in long arcs across the boiling wake. The stout rope connecting his jaw to the two fishermen sizzled through the water as if it were hot.
Nice fish, Geryon called to the struggling pair.
Dornick's quick answering grin was like the sun coming up. They quartered into an increasingly stiff wind for the remainder of the day. As the light began to fade, they were far from land. Geryon was by now certain that the captain and the steersman could manage, and he went forward to join the little group, standing amidships around Dernick's huge fish.
"Now that you have got him, where are you going to find a pan big enough to cook him?"
Silk was asking the smith. A brief frown crossed Dernick's face, but then he smiled again.
"Paul will know how to take care of it," he said,
and he went back to admiring the monster lying on the deck.
"Paul knows how to take care of everything."
The sleet had abated, and the dark rolling waves stretched sullenly to the faintly luminous line of the horizon that divided the black waves from an even blacker sky. The Murgle captain came forward in the windy twilight with a worried look on his face. Respectfully, he touched Urgot's sleeve.
"Yes, Captain?"
"I'm afraid there's trouble, Your Majesty."
"What kind of trouble?"
The captain pointed toward the line of the southern horizon. A half-dozen ships were running before the wind, coming directly toward them. Urgot's face grew slightly sick.
"Malorians?"
The captain nodded.
"Do you think they've seen us?"
"Almost certainly, Your Majesty."
"We'd better go talk to Belgrath," Silk said. "I don't think any of us counted on this."
The conference in the aft cabin was tense. "They're making much better time than we are, Grandfather. We're quartering the wind, and they're running with it dead astern. I think we're going to have to turn north at least until we can get out of their sight." The old man was staring at a tattered map the captain had brought with him. He shook his head.
"I don't like it. This gulf we're in right now funnels into the mouth of the Goron Sea. I do not want to get trapped in there."
He turned to Silk.
"You have been to Meloria a few times. How good are their ships?"
Silk shrugged.
"About the same as this one. I'm not trying to be offensive, Captain, but Angoraks aren't the same kind of sailors or shipbuilders that the Kareks are."
He considered it.
"There might be a way to escape them. Melorians are timid sailors, so they will not spread all sail at night. If we turn north and put up every ounce of canvas that we can, we could be a long way ahead of them. No more than a blinking light on the horizon once it gets dark. Then we drop the sails, reset the rigging, and put out every light on board ship."
"But we can't do that," the captain objected. "It's against the law."
"I will write you an excuse, Captain," Urgot said dryly.
"It's too dangerous, Your Majesty. If we run without lights, we could collide with another ship out there in the dark. We could be sunk."
"Captain," Urgot said in a patient tone, "there are 6 Meloian ships chasing us. What do you imagine they are going to do if they catch up with us?"
"They'll sink us, of course."
"Then, what difference does it make? At least if we put out the lights, we will have a chance. Go ahead, Keldar."
Silk shrugged.
"There isn't much more. After we blow out the running lights, we hoist sail and run east again. The Melorians won't be able to see us, and they'll charge right on across our wake. By tomorrow morning, they won't have any idea about where we are."
"It might just work," Belgarath conceded. "It is dangerous," the captain said disapprovingly.
"Sometimes even breathing is dangerous, Captain," Urgot told him. "Let's try it and see what happens. What I can't understand, though, is what the Malorian ships are doing this far west."
"It's possible that they are marauders sent to harry the coastlines," Zadi suggested.
Perhaps, Urgot said dubiously.
They ran due north before the rising wind that swept up from the south polar ice cap. The deck lantern swung and bobbed in the wind, filling the storm-whipped rigging with wildly dancing shadows. The 6 Melorian vessels, running cautiously under half-sail, dropped behind until their running lights looked no larger than tiny twinkling stars on the horizon far astern. Then,
About midnight, the captain gave the order to drop sails. The sailors quickly reset the rigging, and the ship's master came aft to where Geryon stood beside the steersman.
"Everything's ready, my lord."
"All right, then. Let's blow out all of the lights and see if we can sneak out of here."
The Murgo's stiff face creased uncertainly into a rueful grin.
"When we get out of this, if we get out of it, I think I'll take to my bed for a month."
He raised his voice to a shout.
"Extinguish all the deck lights!"
The resulting blackness was so intense as to be very nearly palpable.
"Hoist the sails!"
the captain shouted. Geryon could hear the creaking pulleys and the flapping of canvas. Then there was the heavy boom of the sails catching the wind, and the ship heeled over as she swung to starboard.
"There's no way to be sure of our direction, my lord," the captain warned. "We have not got a fixed point of any kind to refer to."
"Use those,"
Geryon suggested, pointing at the winking deck lights on the Malorian vessels trailing far behind. "We might as well get some use out of them." Their darkened scow moved eastward with her sharply angled sails cracking in the wind. The deck lights of the Malorian ships that had been pursuing them continued their cautious northward course, crossing far behind and winking out of sight.
"May Torak guide them to a reef," the captain muttered fervently.
"It worked,"
Urgot said delightedly, clapping the seaman on the shoulder.
"By the gods, it actually worked."
"I just hope that nobody catches me running at night without any lights," the captain brooded.
Dawn came, smudged and bleary to the murky eastern horizon, rising slowly up out of a now low-lying shadow some 10 leagues or so ahead.
"That is the coast of Taha," the captain said.
"Is there any sign of the Malorian ships?"
Urgot asked, peering around at the heavy sea. The captain shook his head.
"They passed astern of us during the dog watch, Your Majesty. They are halfway up by the Goran Sea by now."
The seaman looked at Geryon.
"You wanted to get closer into shore and then swing around to starboard again?"
"To starboard, of course."
The captain squinted at the sails.
"We'll have to reset that rigging again, I suppose."
"I'm afraid not," Geryon told him regretfully. "When we turn south, we'll be sailing directly into the wind. You'll have to furl your sails and break out the oars."
He noted the disappointed expression on the seaman's face.
"I'm sorry, Captain, but there are limits. Your sails are the wrong shape, and when you get right down to it, rowing in this case will actually be faster. How far north were we swept last night?"
"A goodly way, my lord,"
the captain replied, peering at the indistinct coastline lying ahead.
"You can put a lot of water behind you moving under full sail before a wind like that. I wouldn't be surprised to see the mouth of the Goran Sea somewhere ahead."
"We do not want to go in there. Let's not start playing tag with those Malorian ships again, particularly in tight quarters. I'm going below for a bite of breakfast and some dry clothes. Send someone down if anything happens."
"I will, my lord."
They had fish for breakfast that morning. At Polgara's suggestion, Durnek's huge catch had been cut into steaks and then delicately broiled over a low flame.
"All delicious, isn't they?"
Durnek asked proudly.
"Yes, dear,"
Polgara agreed.
"He's a very nice fish."
"Did I tell you how I caught him, Paul?"
"Yes, dear, but that's all right. You can tell me again if you'd like."
As they were just finishing their meal, the Murgo captain entered wearing a tarred cape and an anxious expression.
"There's more of them, my lord,"
he blurted to Geryon.
"More of what?"
"Malorians. There's another squadron coming up the Taka coast."
Urgot's face blanched and his hands started trembling.
"Are you sure they aren't the same ones who were chasing us last night?"
Geryon asked and got quickly to his feet.
"There's no way that they could be, my lord. It's a different group of ships."
Silk was looking narrowly at the ship's master.
"Captain, have you ever been in business for yourself?"
The captain threw a brief, guilty glance at Urgot.
"I don't know what you're talking about," he mumbled. "Oh, this is no time for false modesty, Captain.
We are charging headlong into the midst of a Malorian squadron. Are there any coves or inlets around here where we could get out of sight?"
Not along this coast, Your Highness, but right after you go through the channel into the Goran Sea. There is a small bay to the starboard. It's well hidden by some reefs. If we were to unstep the mast and tie bushes along the sides, I think we could escape notice.
Well, let's do it then, Captain, Belgorath said shortly. What's the weather look like?
Not very pleasant. There's a heavy cloud bank coming up from the south. I think we can expect a gale before noon.
Good.
Good?
We are not alone in these waters. A nice gale ought to give the Malorians something to do besides lining the rails of their ships looking for us. Go, give the orders, Captain. Let's turn around and make a run for it.
How were you so sure that the Captain knew about a secluded cove or bay?
Urgot asked Silk after the seaman had left. Silk shrugged.
You levy taxes on merchandise. That gets moved from one place to another, don't you?
Of course, I need the revenue.
A resourceful man with his own boat can sort of forget to stop by the customs dock at the end of a voyage, or he can locate some quiet place to store things until he finds customers for them.
That's smuggling.
Why, yes, I believe some people do call it that. Anyway, I would guess that every sea captain in the world has dabbled in the business at one time or another.
Not Murgos, Urgot insisted.
Then how is it your captain knew of a perfect hiding place, not 5 leagues from our present location, and probably knows hundreds of more?
You are a corrupt and disgusting man, Keldar.
Why, no. Smuggling is a very profitable business, though. You ought to give some thought to it. Yourself.
Keldar, I am the king. I would be stealing from myself.
Oh, trust me, Silk said. It is a bit complicated, but I can show you how to set things up so that you can make a very handsome profit.
The ship rolled then, and they all looked out through the windows along the stern to watch the waves sweeping by as the steersman pulled his tiller over hard, and the ship came about. Far astern they could see a half-dozen red sails looking tiny in the distance.
"Are there any Grolums on board those ships, Paul?"
Belgorath asked his daughter. Her lavender eyes became distant for a moment. Then she passed one hand over her brow. "No, father. Just ordinary Malorians."
"Good. We shouldn't have too much trouble hiding from them, then." "What storm the captain mentions coming up behind them," Dernick said.
"Won't it just hurry them along?"
Urgot asked nervously.
"Oh, probably not," the smith answered. "Most likely they'll come about to head into the wind. Why, it's the only safe way to ride out a storm."
"Won't we have to do the same thing?"
"We're outnumbered 6-1, my brother,"
Silk pointed out.
"We're going to have to take a few chances, I think." The advancing wave of darkness that marked the leading edge of oncoming storm engulfed the red sails far astern, then came racing up the coast. The waves grew higher. The Murgo ship bucked and plunged as the wind picked up. The timbers shrieked and groaned in protest as the heavy seas wrenched at their vessel. High overhead, there was the heavy booming of the sails. Garion actually listened to that booming sound for several minutes before the significance of it began to dawn on him. It was an ominous grinding noise from amidships that finally alerted him.
"That idiot!"
he exclaimed, leaping to his feet and snatching up his cloak.
"What's the matter?"
Tsadi asked with alarm. "He's carrying full sail. If his mainmast doesn't break, he will be driven under." Garion whirled, dashing out of the cabin and staggering along the lurching companionway to the 3 steps leading up to the deck. "Captain!" he shouted, as he dashed out into the rain-swept deck. He caught one of the hastily strung lifelines as a wave broke over the stern and came rushing knee-deep down the deck, sweeping his feet out from under him. "Captain!" he shouted again, hauling himself hand over hand up the rope toward the aft deck.
"Aylard!"
the captain shouted back with a startled look. "Shorten your sail! Your mainmast is starting to tear free!" The captain stared aloft, his face filled with sudden chagrin.
"Impossible, my lord," he protested as Garion reached him. "The men cannot furl sail in this storm."
Garion rubbed the rain out of his eyes and looked back up over his shoulder at the tautly bellied mainsail.
"They'll have to cut it away, then."
"Cut it? But my lord, that's a new sail."
"Right now, it's the sail or the ship. If the wind uproots your mainmast, it's going to tear your ship apart, and if it doesn't, we'll be driven under. Now get that sail off the mast, or I will.
The captain stared at him.
Believe me, Garion told him. If I have to do it, I'll sweep your deck clean, masts, rigging, sails, and all.
The captain immediately began giving orders. Once the mainsail had been cut free and allowed to kite off into the storm, the dreadful shuddering and grinding eased, and the vessel ran before the wind more smoothly, propelled only by a small foresail.
How far is it to the mouth of the Gorand Sea?
Not far, my lord, the captain replied, mopping his face.
He looked around at the storm-lashed morning, and the low, nearly invisible coast sliding by on their right.
There it is,
he said, pointing at a scarcely visible hillock, jutting up a mile or so ahead.
You see that headland, the one with the white bluff facing us? The channel's just on the other side of that.
He turned to the sailors, clinging to the aft rail.
Drop that sea anchor, he commanded.
What's that for?
Garion asked.
We've got too much headway, my lord. The channel is a little difficult. We have to turn sharply to get through it. We've got to slow down. The sea anchor drags behind, keeping us from going quite so fast.
Garion thought about it, frowning. Something seemed wrong, but he couldn't quite put his finger on it. He watched as the sailors rolled what appeared to be a long canvas sack on a heavy rope over the stern rail. The sack streamed out behind them. The rope went taut, and the ship shuddered and slowed perceptibly.
Hey, that's better, the captain said with some satisfaction.
Garion shielded his eyes from the icy rain being driven into his face and peered back behind them. The Malorians were nowhere in sight.
Just how tricky is this channel you mentioned?
There are some reefs in the center, my lord. You have to hug the coast on one side or on the other to avoid them. We will stay close to the south shore since that bay I mentioned is on that side.
Garion nodded.
I'll go warn the others that we're about to make a turn to the right. A sudden change of direction might toss them around a bit down there.
Starboard,
the captain said disapprovingly.
What? Oh, no, to most of them it's to the right.
Garion started forward, peering out through the rain at the low coast sliding past them. The bluff and the rounded headland looming above was almost dead amidships now. He could see the channel just ahead cluttered with jagged, upthrusting rocks. He swung down into the narrow, dark companionway and shook as much of the water out of his cloak as possible as he stumbled aft. He opened the main cabin door and poked his head inside.
We're at the mouth of the Gorand Sea. We'll be turning to starboard here.
Then he cursed at forgetting.
Which way is starboard?
Tsinedra asked him.
To the right.
Why didn't you just say to the right, then?
He let it pass. When we come about, we could bounce around a bit, so you had better all hang on to something. There's a reef in the center of the channel, so we're going to have to swing in tight to the south shore to avoid. And then it came to him. Even as the ship heeled over and plunged into the channel.
Baylor,
he swore. He spun, reaching over his shoulder for Iron Grip's sword. He plunged down the companionway, banging out through the slanting companionway doors and jumping up to the rain-swept aft deck with a great blade held aloft.
Cut it, he screamed. Cut the rope to the sea anchor.
The captain gaped at him, uncomprehending.
"Cut that cursed rope!" Garion bellowed.
Then he was on them, and they stumbled clumsily over each other, trying to get out of his way. The ship had already swept in a tight curve close in to the headland, avoiding the reefs and upthrusting boulders in mid-channel. The submerged sea anchor, however, pulled up by the force of the waves running before the wind, continued on across the mouth of the channel. The rope that had slackened until it was lost in the whitecaps suddenly snapped taut, jerking the Murgo scow askew. The force of that sudden sideways jerk threw Garion off of his feet, and he crashed into the tangle of arms and legs at the rail.
"Cut it!"
he shouted, struggling to free himself.
"Cut that rope!"
But it was too late. The heavy sea anchor, pulled up by the irresistible force of the storm-driven waves, had not only jerked the Murgo vessel to a halt, but was now pulling her inexorably backward, not toward the safe channel through which she had just passed, but instead, directly toward the jagged reefs. Garion staggered to his feet, kicking the floundering sailors out from under his ankles. Desperately, he swung a massive blow at the tautly thrumming rope, shearing away not merely the rope itself, but the stout windlass to which it was attached.
"My lord,"
the captain protested.
"Get that tiller," Garion shouted. "Turn starboard! Turn! Turn! Turn!"
He pointed at the deadly reefs foaming directly in their path. The captain gaped at that huge knife-edged rock standing in his vessel's course. Then he whirled and tore the tiller from the hands of his frozen steersman. Instinctively, he swung the tiller hard over for a turn to port. "Starboard!" Garion shouted. "Turn to starboard!"
"No, my lord," the captain disagreed. "We have to turn to port. To the left."
"We're going backward, you jackass! Turn right!"
"Starboard!"
the captain corrected absently, still wrestling with an idea he was not yet fully prepared to grasp. All the while, still firmly holding the tiller locked into the fatal course he had originally set. Garion began to clamber over the still floundering sailors, desperately trying to reach the bemused captain. But there came a sudden tearing sound from below the waterline, and a lurching jolt as their ship crashed stern first into the reef. Timbers shrieked and snapped as the sharp rocks knifed into the vessel's bottom. Then they hung there, impaled on the rocks, while the waves began the deadly pounding that would soon break the ship to pieces. Chapter 19. Garion struggled to his feet, shaking his head to clear it of the ringing sound and to chase the dancing sparks from before his eyes. The sudden jolt of the ship striking the reef had tumbled him headlong into the aft rail, and there was a great stinging welt across the top of his scalp. The air around him was filled with sound. There were shouts from the deck, cries for help coming from the water. The ship groaned and shook as she hung on the reef, and the surging waves pounded her splintered bottom on the unseen rocks beneath her keel. Wincing, Garion shook his head again and began to slip and slide his way across the heaving aft deck toward the companionway door. As he reached it, however, Belgarath and Durnik came crashing out.
"What has happened?" the old man demanded.
"We hit a reef," Garion said. "Is anybody down there hurt?"
"Oh, they're all right. A little tumbled about is all."
Garion touched the welt on top of his head, wincing at the sharp sting. Then he looked at his fingers, noting that there did not seem to be any blood.
"What's the matter?"
"I hit my head."
"I thought we had all decided that you were not going to do that anymore."
A deadly jarring boom came from under their feet, and with it the sound of splintering timbers.
"Belgarath," Durnik said with alarm, "we're caught on this reef. The surf's going to pound this ship to pieces."
Belgarath looked around quickly.
"Where is the captain?" he demanded.
Garion turned to look aft. "He was right there at the tiller, grandfather." He clambered up the short incline to the aft deck and caught a hold of the steersman who was stumbling forward.
"Where's the captain?"
"Lost. He was thrown over the aft rail when we hit the reef."
The steersman's eyes were filled with shock and fright. "We're all doomed," he cried, clinging to Garion.
"Oh, stop that," Garion snapped. "The captain's gone, grandfather," he shouted over the noise of the storm and the confusion on the deck.
Belgarath and Durnik came quickly up the three steps to the aft deck.
"We'll have to take care of it ourselves, then. How much time do you think we have got, Durnik?"
"Not much. There's a lot of timbers breaking down in the hold. You can hear the water pouring in already."
"We've got to get her off this reef, then, before the rocks break any more holes in the bottom. Well, the reef's the only thing that's keeping us upright now, Belgarath. If we lift her off, she'll sink in minutes." "Then we'll have to beach her. Come along, both of you."
He led them aft and took hold of the tiller bar. He jiggled it back and forth a couple of times, then swore.
"Oh, this rudder's gone."
He drew in a deep breath to calm himself and then turned to Garion and Durnik.
"We'll do this all at one time and all together. If we start heaving and hauling and bouncing her around, we will just tear her up all the more."
He wiped the rain and spray out of his face and peered toward the shore, perhaps a mile distant. He pointed at the upthrusting headland with a white bluff on one side, dropping straight down into the thundering surf.
"There's a beach just to the left of that bluff. We'll try for that. It's not too well sheltered, and there are a lot of rocks sticking up out of the sand, but it is the closest."
Durnik leaned far out over the aft rail and peered down.
"She's badly broached, Belgarath."
He squinted across the intervening water toward the beach.
"I only hope there's speed. Once she's clear of this reef, she'll start to go down. We're going to have to push her toward the beach as fast as we can, and without a rudder it's going to be very hard to control our direction." "Do we have any other options?" Belgarath asked him. "Not that I can think of, no." "Well, let's do it, then.
Are we ready?
Geryon and Durnik both nodded, then straightened, concentrating hard as each of them drew in and focused his will. Geryon began to tingle all over and clenched himself tightly, holding in the pent-up force.
Now! Belgareth barked. Lift!
The three of them said in unison. The battered stern of the ship came sluggishly up out of the churning waves, with her shattered timbers shrieking as the hull pulled free of the jagged reef.
There!
Belgareth snapped, pointing at the half-obscured beach. Geryon thrust, bracing his will astern at the boiling reef. The ship settled sickeningly as she came free, going down rapidly by the stern, then slowly at first, but quickly gaining speed, she surged forward. Even over the sound of the howling wind, he could hear the rushing wash of water along her sides as she raced toward the safety of the beach. When they hit the currents in the main channel, however, the rudderless ship began to veer and yaw, threatening to swing broadside.
"Keep her straight!" Belgareth shouted.
The veins were standing out in his forehead, and his jaws were tightly clenched. Geryon labored at it. As long as their broken ship moved fast enough, they could keep the water from pouring in through the shattered stern. But if she went broadside to the waves, the loss of momentum would be fatal. The sea would inexorably drag her under. Geryon gripped the bow with the force of his will, holding the ship rigidly on course, even as he continued to drive toward the beach with all of his strength. 300 more yards. Sweating and straining, Geryon could see the foaming surf seething on the sandy boulder-strewn beach. 200 yards. He could hear the thunder of the waves. 100 yards. He could feel the ponderous, upward-heaving swell of the great wave that rose beneath them and rushed toward the safety, only scant yards away. And then, even as the prow touched the froth-covered sand, the great swell that had driven them up onto the beach subsided, and there was a dreadful, shocking crash from amidships as they came down onto a submerged boulder lurking beneath the surf. Again Geryon was thrown face down on the deck and half-stunned by the impact. The surf still boomed about them, and the snapping and splintering of timbers amidships was deafening. But they were safe. The prow of the stricken vessel was firmly embedded in the wet sand of the beach. As Geryon painfully hauled himself to his feet, he felt drained and weak from his effort. Then the deck beneath his feet gave a peculiar sickening lurch, and there were more cracking and splintering noises coming from amidships.
"I think we broke the keel when we hit that rock," Durnik said shakily.
His face was gray with exhaustion, and he was shaking visibly.
"We'd better get everyone off this ship and onto that beach."
Belgareth rose from the scuppers. There was a ruddy contusion on his cheek, rain and spray streaming down his face, and a vast anger in his eyes. He was swearing so furiously, then his rage suddenly vanished.
"The horses! They are down in the hold, Durnik."
But the smith was already running forward toward the sprung hatchway amidships.
"Get Toth to come and help me," he shouted back over his shoulder. "We'll have to get those horses out."
"Geryon," Belgareth barked. "Let's get everyone out of the cabins and onto dry land. I don't think we've got a lot of time before this wreck starts to break apart."
They started forward, moving carefully on the slanting deck of the broken ship, with the wind-whipped spray and driving rain stinging at their faces. They ducked into the slanting aft door and down the companionway. The narrow hall echoed and rang with the noise of cracking timbers coming from amidships. The aft cabin was total shambles. The shock of striking the reef and the even worse one that had broken the ship's back had torn most of the bolted-down furniture loose. Sprung timbers flopped and clattered. The windows across the stern had all been broken and wrenched from their casings. Spray and rain were splashing in through those gaping holes. Zenedra and Prala looked frightened as they clung to each other. Urgot held tightly to the keel post as if expecting yet another crashing impact, and Thoddy half lay in a corner with his arms protectively wrapped around his red leather case. Polgara, however, looked dreadfully angry. She was wet. The water pouring in through the shattered stern had drenched her clothes and her hair, and her expression was that of one who has been enormously offended.
"Exactly what did you do, old man?"
she demanded of Belgareth, as he and Geryon entered through the broken door.
"We hit a reef, Paul. We were taking on water. We had to beach the ship."
She considered that for a moment, obviously trying to find something wrong with it.
"We can talk about it later." He looked around. "Is everyone all right? We've got to get off of this wreck immediately."
We are as well as can be expected, Father. What's the problem? I thought you said we were on the beach.
We hit a submerged rock and broke the keel. This part of the ship's still in the water, and about the only thing that's holding this tub in one piece right now is the pitch in her seams. We have got to get forward and off of this ship at once.
She nodded. I understand, Father. She turned to the others. Gather up whatever you can carry. We have to get ashore. I'll go help Dernick with the horses, Geryon said to Belgarath. Toth, Eriand, come with me.
He turned toward the door, but paused a moment to look at Zenedra.
Are you all right?
I think so,
she replied, sounding frightened and rubbing at an ugly bruise on her knee.
Stay with Aunt Paul, he instructed curtly, then went out.
The scene in the ship's hold was even worse than he had expected. Knee-deep water swirled and sloshed in the half-light coming in through the splintered hull. Boxes, bags, and bales floated everywhere. The top of the sloshing bilge smelling water was littered with splinters from the broken timbers. Dernick had herded the wild-eyed horses forward, and they were bunched together in the ship's bow, where the water was the shallowest.
We lost three of them. Two with broken necks, one drowned.
Horse?
Eriand asked quickly.
He's all right, Eriand, Dernick assured him.
He turned back to Geryon.
I've been trying to gather up the packs. Everything's pretty wet, I'm afraid. The food packs were all back in the stern, though. No way to get to them.
We can deal with that later, Geryon said. The main thing now is to get these horses out.
Dernick squinted at the jagged edges of the 2-foot square keel grinding together as the aft end of the ship swung sluggishly in the surging waves.
Too dangerous. We'll have to go out through the bow. I'll get my axe.
Geryon shook his head.
If the aft end breaks loose, the bow section's likely to roll. We could lose another 4 or 5 horses if that happens. We might not have too much time left.
Dernick drew in a deep breath and squared his broad shoulders. His face was not happy.
I know, Geryon said, putting his hand on his friend's arm. I'm tired, too. Let's do it up forward. No point in breaking out the hole someplace where we'll have to jump into deep water.
It was not quite as difficult as they had expected. The assistance of Toth made a noticeable difference. They selected a space in the ship's side between a pair of stout ribs and went to work. As Dernick and Geryon began carefully to break out the ship's timbers between the ribs with the force of concentrated will, Toth attacked the same area with a large iron pry bar. The combination of sorcery and the mute's enormous physical strength quickly opened a low, narrow opening in the ship's bow. Silk stood on the beach, out of range of the splinters their efforts had sent flying. His cloak was whipping wildly in the wind. The surf was swirling about his ankles.
"Are you all right?"
he shouted over the noise of the storm.
"Good enough," Geryon shouted back. "Give us a hand with the horses."
It eventually took blindfolds. Despite the best efforts of Dernick and Eriand to calm them, the terrified horses could be moved only if they could not see the dangers in the sloshing water surging around their knees. One by one, they had to be led and coaxed through the litter, lying half awash in the shattered hold, and then out into the foaming surf. When the last of their animals was clear and stood flinching on the sand with the driving rain lashing at the flanks, Geryon turned back to the sluggishly heaving wreck.
"Let's get the packs out," he shouted to the others. "Save what you can, but don't take any chances."
The Murgo sailors, after leaping from the bow of the ship to the sand, had retreated up the beach and had taken dubious shelter on the leeward side of a large upthrusting rock. They stood clustered together, sullenly watching the unloading. Geryon and the others heaped up the packs above the frothy line that marked the highest point reached by the waves.
"We lost 3 horses and all of the food packs," Geryon reported to Belgarath and Polgara. "I think we got everything else, except what we had to leave behind in the cabins."
Belgarath squinted upward into the rain.
"We can redistribute the packs, but we are going to need food."
"Is the tide going in or out?"
Silk asked as he deposited the last pack of their heap of belongings. Dernick squinted at the storm-tossed channel leading into the Goran Sea.
"Oh, I think it's just turning."
"We don't really have too much of a problem, then," the little man said. "Let's find some place out of the wind, wait for the tide to go out. Then we can come back and ransack the wreck at our leisure. She ought to be completely out of the water at low tide."
"All this... just one thing wrong with your plan, Prince Skeldar,"
Zadi told him, squinting toward the upper end of the beach.
"You're forgetting those Smurgo sailors. They're stranded on a deserted coast, with at least a dozen Malorian ships cruising up and down the shoreline looking for them. Malorians enjoy killing Murgos almost as much as Aelorns do, so those sailors are going to want to get far away from here. It might be wise to get these horses quite some distance away. If we want to keep them...
Let's load the pack horses and get mounted, Belgarath decided. I think Sadi is right. We can come back and pick over what's left of the ship later.
They broke down the packs and redistributed the weight to make up for the three lost animals, and then began to saddle their mounts. The sailors, led by a tall, heavy-shouldered Murgo with an evil-looking scar under his left eye, came back down the beach.
"Where do you think you're taking the horses?"
he demanded.
"I can't really see where that's any of your business," Zadi replied.
"We're going to make it our business, aren't we, mates?"
There was a rumble of agreement from the rain-soaked sailors.
"The horses belong to us," Zadi told him.
"We don't care about that. There are enough of us so that we can take anything we want."
"We stay with Tok,"
one of the sailors behind the scar-faced man shouted.
"Right," the big Murgo agreed. He drew a short, rusty sword from the sheath at his hip, looked back over his shoulder as he raised it aloft, then shouted,
"Follow me!"
Then he fell writhing and bellowing in pain to the wet sand, clutching at his broken right arm. Toth, without any change of expression, and with an almost negligent sidearm flip, had sent the iron pry bar he still held in one hand spinning through the air with a whirring flutter that ended with a sharp crack as the sword-wielding Murgo's arm snapped. The sailors drew back, alarmed by their leader's sudden collapse. Then a stubble-cheeked fellow in the front rank lifted a heavy boat-hook.
"Hush them," he bellowed. "We want those horses, and we outnumber them."
"I think you might want to count again," Polgara said in a cool voice. Even as Geryon stepped forward, drawing his sword out of its sheath, he felt a peculiar shadowy presence to his left. He blinked unbelievingly. As real as if he were actually there, the huge red-bearded shape of Berak stood at his side. A clinking sound came from the right, and there, his armor gleaming wet in the rain, stood Mandorallan. And somewhat beyond him, the hawk-faced Hetar.
"Now, what thinkest thou, my lords?"
the figure that appeared to be the invincible Baron of Volmander said gaily.
"Should we afford these knaves the opportunity to flee ere we fall upon them and spill out their life-blood?"
"It seems like the decent thing to do,"
the apparition of Berak rumbled its agreement.
"What do you think, Hetar?"
"They are Murgos,"
the shade of Hetar said in his quiet, chilling voice, as he drew his saber.
"Kill them all right here, and now. That way we won't have to waste time chasing them down, one by one, later."
"Somehow, I knew that you were going to look at it that way,"
Berak laughed then.
"All right, my lords, let's go to work."
He drew his heavy sword. The three images, larger, actually, than they were in life, advanced grimly on the shrinking sailors. In their midst, painfully aware that he was in fact quite alone, Geryon moved forward, his huge sword held low. Then, on the far side of the apparition of Berak, he saw Toth advancing with his huge staff. Beyond him, Zadi held a small poisoned dagger. At the opposite end of the line, Durnik and Silk moved into place. The image of Berak glanced over at Geryon.
"Now, Geryon,"
Polgara whispered, her voice coming from those bearded lips. Instantly, he understood. He relaxed the restraints he usually kept on the orb. The great sword he held leaped into flame, spurting blue fire from its tip, almost into the faces of the now terrified Murgos.
"Will all of you who would like to die immediately, and save yourselves the inconvenience and discomfort of being chased down and slowly hacked to pieces, please step forward?"
The red-bearded shadow at Geryon's side roared in tones more grandiose than Berak himself could ever have managed.
"We can have you in the arms of your one-eyed god in the blinking of an eye."
It
hung there for a moment. Then the sailors fled.
"Oh, gods!"
Geryon heard Polgara's ringing voice coming from behind him.
"I have wanted to do that for 1,000 years."
He turned and saw her, standing with the raging sea and racing black clouds behind her, and the wind tearing at her blue cloak. The rain had plastered her hair to her face and neck, but her glorious eyes were triumphant.
"My Paul!" Belgareth exulted, catching her in a rough embrace. "Gods, what a son you would have made!"
"I am your daughter, Belgareth," she replied simply. "But could any son have done better?"
"No, Paul," he laughed suddenly, crushing her to him and soundly planting a kiss on her rain-wet cheek. "Not one bit."
They stopped, startled and even a little embarrassed that the enormous love they had each tried to conceal for millennia had finally come out into the open on this storm-swept beach here at the bottom of the world. Almost shyly, they looked at each other, and then, unable to hold it in, they began to laugh. Geryon turned away, his eyes suddenly brimming. Urgot was bending over the sailor with the broken arm.
"If you wouldn't mind taking some advice from your king, my man, might I remind you that the sea out there is crawling with Malorians, and Malorians take a childlike delight in crucifying every Murgo they come across. Don't you think it might be prudent for you and your shipmates to remove yourselves from the vicinity of all of that scrap lumber?"
He looked meaningfully at the wreck. The sailor cast a sudden, frightened glance at the storm-tossed channel and scrambled to his feet. Cradling his broken arm, he scurried back up the beach to rejoin his frightened mates.
"He shows a remarkable grasp of the situation, doesn't he?"
Urgot said to Silk.
"He does seem uncharacteristically alert," Silk agreed. He looked at the rest of them.
"Why don't we mount up and get off of this beach?" he suggested.
"That wreck stands out like a beacon, and our injured friend and his companions might decide to give horse-wrestling another try."
He looked appraisingly at the hulking images Polgara had conjured up.
"Just out of curiosity, Polgara, could those apparitions of yours actually have done any good if it had gotten down to a fight?"
Polgara was still laughing, her lavender eyes alight.
"To be perfectly honest with you, my dear Silk,"
she replied gaily,
"I haven't got the faintest idea."
For some reason, her answer sent them all off into helpless gales of laughter. Chapter 20 The slope leading to the top of the headland was covered with rank grass, drooping under the rain that swept in from the south. As they started up from the beach, Geryon looked back. The Murgo sailors had swarmed over the wreck to salvage whatever they could, stopping often to look fearfully out at the storm-racked channel. At the top of the headland, the full force of the gale struck them, tearing at their clothes and raking them with sheets of rain. Belgareth pulled to a halt, held one hand above his eyes to shield them, and surveyed the treeless expanse of grassland, lying sodden and wind-whipped ahead.
"This is totally impossible, father," Polgara declared, drawing her wet cloak more tightly around her. "We are going to have to find shelter and wait this out."
"That might be difficult, Paul."
He gazed out over the grassland that showed no signs of any sort of human habitation. The broad valley, lying below them, was laced with deep gullies where turbulent creeks had cut down through the turf, exposing the rounded boulders and beds of gravel lying beneath the thin topsoil and its tenacious cover of grass. The wind sheeted across that grass, tossing it like waves. The rain mingled with icy sleet raked at it.
"Urgot," the old man said, "are there any villages or settlements hereabouts?"
Urgot wiped at his face and looked around.
"I don't think so," he replied. "The maps don't show anything in this part of Tacha, except the high road leading inland. We might be able to stumble across some isolated farmstead, but I doubt it. The soil here is too thin for crops, and the winters are too severe for cattle."
The old man nodded gloomily.
"That's more or less what I thought." "We might be able to pitch a tent, though," Durnick said. "But we would be right out in the open,
There's no firewood anywhere out there.
Eriond had been patiently sitting astride his stallion, staring out at the featureless landscape with a peculiar look of recognition.
Couldn't we take shelter in the watchtower?
What watchtower?
Bilgarath asked him, looking around again.
I don't see anything.
Oh, you can't see it from here. It's mostly all tumbled down. The cellar's still all right, though.
I don't know of any watchtowers on this coast, Urgot said.
It hasn't been used for a long time.
Where, Eriond? Polgara asked.
Can you show us where it is? Well, of course, it's not too far.
The young man turned his stallion and angled up toward the very top of the headland. As they climbed the hill, Geryon looked down and saw a fair number of stone blocks protruding up out of the grass. It was difficult to say for sure, but at least some of those blocks bore what looked vaguely like chisel marks. When they reached the top, the gale shrieked around them, and the tossing grass whipped at the horse's legs.
"Are you sure, Eriond?"
Polgara shouted over the wind.
"We can get in from the other side," he replied confidently. "It might be better to lead the horses, though. The entrance is fairly close to the edge of the bluff."
He slid out of his saddle and led the way across the grassy, rounded top of the hill. The rest of them followed him.
"Be careful here,"
he warned, moving around a slight depression.
"Part of the roof is sagging a bit."
Just past that grass-covered depression was a bank that angled steeply downward to a narrow ledge. Beyond that, the bluff broke away sharply. Eriond picked his way down the bank and led his horse along the ledge. Geryon followed him. When he reached the ledge, he glanced over the edge of the bluff. Far below, he saw the wreck lying on the beach. A broad line of footprints stretched away from it at the water's edge to disappear into the rain.
"Here it is,"
Eriond said. Then he disappeared, leading his horse, it seemed, directly into the grass-covered bank. The rest of them followed curiously and found a narrow arched opening that had quite obviously been built by human hands. The long grass above and on each side of the arch had grown over it until it was barely visible. Gratefully, Geryon pushed his way through that grass-obscured opening into a calm, musty-smelling darkness.
"Did anyone think to bring any torches?"
Teddy asked.
"Are they worth the food packs, I'm afraid?" Durnick apologized. "Yeah, now, let's see what I can do."
Geryon felt a light surge and heard a faint rushing sound. A dimly glowing spot of light appeared balanced on the palm of Durnick's hand. Gradually, the dim light grew until they could see the interior of this ancient ruin. Like so many structures that had been built in antiquity, this low-ceilinged cellar was vaulted. Stone arches supported the ceiling, and the walls were solidly buttressed. Geryon had seen precisely the same construction in King Anheg's Aeon's Old Palace in Val Alorn, in the ruins of Awahun, in the lower floors of his own citadel at Riva, and even in the echoing tomb of the One-Eyed God in Tol Mishrak. Silk was looking speculatively at Eriond.
"I'm sure you have an explanation," he said. "How did you know that this place was here?"
"I lived here for a while with Zadar. It was while he was waiting until I'd grow old enough to steal the orb."
Silk looked slightly disappointed.
"Oh, how prosaic," he said.
"I'm sorry,"
Eriond said, as he led the horses over to one side of the vaulted room.
"Would you like to have me make up some kind of story for you instead?"
"Oh, never mind, Eriond," the little man told him.
Urgot had been examining one of the buttresses.
"No Murgo ever built this. The stones fit too closely."
"It was built before the Murgos came to this part of the world."
"By the slave race?"
Urgot asked incredulously.
"Well, they know how to make our mud huts."
"That's what they wanted you to think. They were building towers and cities when Murgos were still living in goatskin tents."
"Could somebody please make a fire?"
Sinedra asked, through chattering teeth.
"I'm freezing."
Geryon looked at her closely and saw that her lips had a bluish tinge to them.
"Oh, the firewood's over here,"
Arion said. He went behind one of the buttresses and emerged with an armload of white bleached sticks.
"Zadar and I used to carry driftwood up from the beach. There's still quite a bit left."
He went to the fireplace in the back wall, dropped the wood, and bent over to peer up the chimney.
"It seems to be clear."
Durnick went to work immediately with his flint, steel, and tinder. In a few moments, a small curl of orange flame was licking up through the little pile of roof splinters he had built on the bed of ash in the fireplace. They all crowded around that tiny flame, thrusting twigs and sticks at it in their eagerness to force it to grow more quickly.
"All that won't do," Durnick said with an uncharacteristic sternness. "You'll only knock it apart and put it out."
They reluctantly backed away from the fireplace. Durnick carefully laid twigs and splinters on the growing flame, then small sticks, and finally larger ones. The flames grew higher and began to spread quickly through the bone-dry wood. The light from the fireplace began to fill the musty cellar, and Geryon could feel a faint warmth on his face.
"All right, then,"
Polgara said, businesslike as usual.
"What are we going to do about food?"